Before we start, I'd like to give a massive shout out to the following people for supporting Stories Telling Stories on Patreon: Jim Ross, Holly, Tamara, and Tom. Thank you so much for your support. If you'd like to help support the show and hear your name listed before future episodes, head on over to patreon.com/storiestellingstories. I don't have any regrets. If I were to die today, I would be content in the life I lived. I'm true to myself, true to my desires, and I've accomplished everything I've set my mind to. I've lived lavishly, loved deeply, embraced a life of honesty and truth, and have nothing but warmth and contentment in my heart. So if death wants to knock on my door tonight, I will go gladly on to the next great adventure. This is an exaggerated sentiment, but nonetheless one that I see often, and one that I feel to be full of insecurity and hot air. To say one lives a life free of regret is to admit that one has been unable to learn the lessons that life has attempted to teach us. Regret, like so many tough life lessons, has become a four-letter word in self-improvement, as if exposure to it renders one a failure. But what's wrong with failure? If you never fall off a bike, never apply for that dream job, never pull your heart from your sleeve and hand it to someone who looks back at it in shock and disgust, how can you consider your life well-rounded, well-lived? My life is full of regrets, and I continue accumulating them with each passing day. As a soft-spoken homebody who feels out of place in crowds and gatherings, who experiences existential dread and social anxiety when forced to interact with strangers or friends of friends, or even the futile attempt to navigate something as commonplace as online dating, I give up a lot to keep myself in a comfortable state. Some may even call this valuable and life-saving in the year of COVID 2020, and some may say I'm perfectly suited to this new normal. I can comfortably go days without leaving my house, and weeks with minimal interaction besides the occasional clerk or delivery driver. But even before this new normal, going back as far as I can remember, I've been racking up regrets, burning moments into memory where I said no, didn't raise my hand, didn't speak up. In 2001, I could have taken 10 steps forward and shook hands with the singer of one of my favorite bands as he casually cut through a crowd, something so many others were doing. A singer that I admired deeply and looked up to as I was just getting started in my rock star stage, who I could have met, however briefly, but wouldn't allow myself to do it. It was nice to at least see him in person, I told myself. You'll get another chance. Except he died suddenly of a previously undiagnosed heart condition just 21 days later. This is a singular example. My social anxiety and introverted attitude cost me a golden opportunity and led to another notch of regret. A big one on the tally card of my life. But just another one out of many. From promotions and perfect prospects to romantic opportunities, lost loves, and the one that got away. Truth be told, I'm perfect for this new normal, because I'm naturally solitary and comfortable in leading a life dominated by regrets. And I know that I'm the outlier, not the norm. And I attempt to take adventures and attend concerts and check off bucket list items as I can to keep the big R in check. But truth be told, I'm mostly living a one-sided life. I don't learn from my regrets. I hoard them and obsess over them in excruciating detail, especially during those 3 a.m. hours when all I want to do is sleep. I may not have the success to show from taking a swing at a questionable fastball, but my regrets reinforce my memory, meaning I never forget that I at least had the chance. An odd optimism, I know. But a great deal of mental gymnastics that manages to keep me sane. And it's not that I don't want these things. To meet my heroes, to send witty icebreakers, or even attempt an introduction of romantic intent, or to meet up with friends or friends of friends and attempt to increase my tiny social circle. It's that it's not who I am. And the core of living a life without regret is to live a life full of honesty to oneself. And in my most honest and true form, I'm a regret collector who is comfortable sitting on the sidelines and observing. My last great relationship blossomed at random with the help of a bottle of silver tequila, but in the socially distanced and isolated age we live in, the likelihood of finding a fellow homebody who would rather sit at home and avoid people is either more likely now than ever before, or never gonna happen in the time of swipes and paid apps. But the unknown in that keeps life exciting. You never know when or where it's going to happen, or if it will even happen at all. And some may call that regretful, but I consider it hopeful. At the end of the day, living a life adverse to regret is just as unhealthy as one where you tally them off over the decades. But somewhere in the middle, we can survive. And regret is the topic that brings up this week's story, episode 15 of Locked in a Vacancy, where we look at a short story about, and titled, Regret, by legendary master of the short story, Guy de Maupassant. And I apologize if my French is brutal and I am absolutely butchering his name. Guy was a popular French author in the mid to late 19th century who was fortunate enough to find success and notoriety in his lifetime. He was prolific in his short years, crafting an impressive body of work that influenced other such notable authors as Anton Chekhov, Kate Chopin, and Henry James. His most notable English work is The Necklace, which has become a piece of classroom reading around the world, as well as a short piece of gothic horror called The Hand that we may revisit closer to Halloween. But as brilliant and prolific as he was, he suffered from mental illness and was committed to an asylum in the last year of his life after a failed suicide attempt, where he would ultimately die at the age of 43. Whether he lived a life of regret or not, we may not know, but peering at the world through his eyes, we can get a bit of a better idea. This is Regret by Guy de Maupassant on Locked in a Vacancy. Monsieur Saval, who was called in Mantis Father Saval, had just risen from bed. He was weeping. It was a dull autumn day. The leaves were falling. They fell slowly in the rain, like a heavier and slower rain. M. Saval was not in good spirits. He walked from the fireplace to the window, and from the window to the fireplace. Life has its somber days. It would no longer have any but somber days for him, for he had reached the age of 62. He is alone, an old bachelor with nobody about him. How sad it is to die alone, all alone, without anyone who's devoted to you. He pondered over his life, so barren, so empty. He recalled former days, the days of his childhood, the home, the house, of his parents, his college days, his follies, the time he studied law in Paris, his father's illness, his death. He then returned to live with his mother. They lived together, very quietly, and desired nothing more. At last, the mother died. How sad life is. He lived alone since then. And now, in his turn, he too will soon be dead. He will disappear, and that will be the end. There will be no more of Paul Saval upon the earth. What a frightful thing. other people will love, will laugh. Yes, people will go on amusing themselves, and he will no longer exist. Is this not strange that people can laugh, amuse themselves, be joyful under that eternal certainty of death? If this death were only probable, one could then have hope, but no, it is inevitable. As inevitable as that night follows the day. If, however, his life had been full, if he had done something, if he had had adventures, great pleasures, success, satisfaction of some kind or another, but no, nothing. He had done nothing. Nothing but rise from bed, eat at the same hours, and go to bed again. And he had gone on like that to the age of 62 years. He had not even taken it unto himself a wife, as other men do. Why? Yes, why was it that he had not married? He might have done so, for he possessed considerable means. Had he lacked an opportunity? Perhaps. But one can create opportunities. He was indifferent. That was all. Indifference has been his greatest drawback, his defect, his vice. How many men wreck their lives through indifference? It is so difficult for some natures to get out of bed, to move about, to take long walks, to speak, to study any question. He had not even been loved. No woman had reposed on his bosom in a complete abandon of love. He knew nothing of the delicious anguish of expectation, the divine vibration of a hand in yours, of the ecstasy of triumphant passion. What superhuman happiness must overflow your heart when lips encounter lips for the first time, when the grasp of four arms makes one being of you, a being unutterably happy. Two beings infatuated with one another. M. Saval was sitting before the fire, his feet on the fender, in his dressing gown. Assuredly, his life had been spoiled, completely spoiled. He had, however, loved. He had loved secretly, sadly, and indifferently, in a manner characteristic of him in everything. Yes, he had loved his old friend, Madame Sanders, the wife of his old companion, Sanders. Ah, if he had known her as a young girl, but he had met her too late. She was already married. Unquestionably, he would have asked her hand. How he had loved her, nevertheless, without respite, since the first day he set eyes on her. He recalled his emotion every time he saw her, his grief on leaving her, the many nights that he could not sleep because he was thinking of her. On rising in the morning, he was somewhat more rational than on the previous evening. Why? How pretty she was formerly, so dainty, with faint curly hair and always laughing. Sanders was not the man she should have chosen. She was now 52 years of age. She seemed happy. If she had only loved him in days gone by. Yes, if she had only loved him. And why should she not have loved him? He, Saval, seeing that he loved her so much. Yes, she, Madame Sanders. If only she could have guessed. Had she not guessed anything? Seen anything? Comprehended anything? What would she have thought? If he had spoken, what would she have answered? And Saval asked himself a thousand other things. He reviewed his whole life, seeking to recall a multitude of details. He recalled all the long evenings spent at the house of Sanders, where the latter's wife was young and so charming. He recalled many things that she had said to him. The intonations of her voice. The little significant smiles that meant so much. He recalled their walks. The three of them together along the banks of the Seine. Their luncheon on the grass on Sundays. For Sanders was employed at the sub-prefecture. And all at once, the distinct recollection came to him of an afternoon spent with her in a little wood on the banks of the river. They had set out in the morning, carrying their provisions in baskets. It was a bright spring morning, one of those days which intoxicate one. Everything smells fresh. Everything seems happy. The voices of the birds sound more joyous and then fly more swiftly. They had luncheon on the grass, under the willow trees, quite close to the water, which glistened in the sun's rays. The air was balmy, charged with the odors of fresh vegetation. They drank it in with delight. How pleasant everything was on that day. After lunch, Sanders went to sleep on the broad of his back. The best nap he had in his life, he said, when he woke up. Madame Sanders had taken the arm of Saval, and they started to walk along the riverbank. She leaned tenderly on his arm. She laughed and said to him, "I'm intoxicated, my friend. I'm quite intoxicated." He looked at her, his heart going pit-a-pat. He felt himself grow pale, fearful that he might have looked too boldly at her, and that the trembling of his hand had revealed his passion. She had made a wreath of wild flowers and water lilies, and she asked him, "Do I look pretty like that?" As he did not have an answer, for he could find nothing to say, he would have liked to go down on his knees. She burst out laughing, a sort of annoyed, displeased laugh, as she said, "Great goose, what ails you? You might at least say something." He felt like crying, but could not even find yet a word to say. All these things came back to him now, as vividly as on the day when they took place. Why had she said this to him? "Great goose, what ails you? You might at least say something." And he recalled how tenderly she had leaned on his arm. And in passing under a shady tree, he had felt her ear brushing his cheek, and he had moved his head abruptly, lest she should suppose he was too familiar. When he had said to her, "Is it not time to return?" she darted a singular look at him. "Certainly," she said. "Certainly," regarding him at the same time in a curious manner. He had not thought of it at the time, but now the whole thing appeared to him quite plain. "Just as you like, my friend. If you are tired, let us go back." And he had answered, "I'm not fatigued, but Sanders might be awake now." And she had said, "If you are afraid of my husband's being awake, that is another thing. Let us return." On their way back, she remained silent and leaned no longer on his arm. Why? At that time, it had never occurred to him to ask himself why. Now he seemed to apprehend something that he had not then understood. Could it? M. Saval felt himself blush, and he got up at a bound, as if he were 30 years younger and had heard Madame Sanders say, "I love you." Was it possible? That idea which had just entered his mind tortured him. Was it possible that he had not seen, had not guessed? Oh, if that were true, if he had let this opportunity of happiness pass without taking advantage of it, he said to himself, "I must know. I cannot remain in this state of doubt. I must
No, he thought. I am 62 years of age. She's 58. I may ask her that now, without giving offense. He started out. The Sanders house was situated on the other side of the street, almost directly opposite his own. He went across and knocked at the door, and a little servant opened it.
You here at this hour, Saval? Has some accident happened to you?
No, my girl, he replied. But go and tell your mistress that I want to speak to her at once.
The fact is, madam is preserving pears for the winter, and she is in the preserving room. She is not dressed, you understand.
Yes, but go and tell her that I wish to see her on a very important matter.
The little servant went away, and Saval began to walk with long, nervous strides up and down the drawing room. He did not feel in the least embarrassed, however. Oh, he was merely going to ask her something, as he would have asked her about some cooking recipe. He was 62 years of age. The door opened, and Madame appeared. She was now a large woman, fat and round, with full cheeks and a sonorous laugh. She walked with her arms away from her sides and her sleeves tucked up, her bare arms all covered with fruit juice. She asked anxiously,
"What is the matter with you, my friend? You are not ill, are you?"
"No, my dear friend. But I wish to ask you one thing, which to me is of the first importance. Something which is torturing my heart. And I want you to promise that you will answer me frankly."
She laughed. "I am always frank. Say on."
"Well, then, I have loved you from the first day I ever saw you. Can you have any doubt of this?"
She responded, laughing with something of her former tone of voice.
"Great goose! What ails you? I knew it from the very first day."
Saval began to tremble. He stammered out, "You knew it? Then..." He stopped. She asked,
"Then?"
He answered, "Then, what do you think, what would you have answered?"
She broke into a peal of laughter. Some of the juice ran off the tips of her fingers and onto the carpet.
"What?"
Why did you not ask me anything? It was not for me to declare myself."
He then advanced a step towards her.
Tell me. You remember the day when Sanders went to sleep on the grass after lunch? When we walked together as far as the bend of the river below?"
He waited, expectantly. She had ceased to laugh and looked at him straight in the eyes.
"Yes, certainly. I remember it,"
he answered, trembling all over. "Well, that day, if I had been venturesome, what would you have done?"
She began to laugh, as only a happy woman can laugh, who has nothing to regret, and responded frankly in a clear voice tinged with irony.
"I would have yielded, my friend."
She then turned on her heels and went back to her jam making. Saval rushed into the street, cast down as though he had met with some disaster.
He walked with giant strides through the rain, straight on, until he reached the riverbank, without thinking where he was going. He then turned to the right and followed the river. He walked a long time, as if urged on by some instinct. His clothes were running with water. His hat was out of shape, as soft as a rag and dripping like a roof. He walked on, straight in front of him. At last, he came to the place where they had lunched on that day so long ago, the recollection of which tortured his heart. He sat down under the leafless trees and wept. The end.
Locked in a Vacancy is produced in collaboration with Stories Telling Stories and STS Media Group, socially isolating itself at Milt House Studios in Milton, Vermont, casting around the globe to your frontal lobe wherever podcasts are found. Locked in a Vacancy is also streaming on YouTube at Stories Telling Stories. Make sure to give us a review wherever you stream our show. We really appreciate it. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Give us a subscribe on YouTube and consider supporting us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. And until next time, stay sane, stay safe, and stay whimsical.